Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're always in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club and the chair for today's program. Today we are pleased to have as our distinguished speaker Dr. Margaret Hamburg, Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. She will be talking about the balance between innovation and the life sciences that is so important to the economy of our region here in the Bay Area, and protection of public health and welfare, which is, of course, important to each and every person in our country. I also want to mention that we are delighted that another distinguished scientist and public policy leader is with us today, Dr. David Hamburg, President Emeritus of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, founder and co-chair of the Carnegie Commission on Preventing Conflict, and now DeWitt Wallace Distinguished Scholar, the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. In addition to being my longtime and esteemed colleague, he's very proud of his daughter, Dr. Margaret Hamburg, and as the saying goes, the apple does not fall far from the tree. Before I introduce Dr. Margaret Hamburg, I also want to let you know that the audience question period a little bit later in the program will be moderated by another eminent scientist, Dr. Susan Desmond-Hellman, as I mentioned before, Chancellor of the UCSF Medical School. Let me introduce them both. Dr. Desmond-Hellman previously served as President of Product Development at Genentech, which during her tenure became the nation's leading producer of anti-cancer drug treatments. Forbes magazine called Dr. Desmond-Hellman one of the world's most powerful innovators, and she has been named to the Biotech Hall of Fame. We are delighted she could be here with us today and that she'll be our honoree at our annual dinner later in the year. And now it's my very great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, FDA Commissioner Dr. Margaret Hamburg. Margaret Hamburg became the U.S. Commissioner of Food and Drugs in May 2009. She was just the second woman ever to be nominated for this position. Dr. Hamburg graduated from Harvard Medical School, completing her residency in internal medicine at the New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell Medical Center. She conducted research on neuroscience at Rockefeller University, studied neuropharmacology at the National Institute of Mental Health, and later focused on AIDS research as assistant director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. From 1991 to 97, Dr. Hamburg served as commissioner of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Her most celebrated achievement was curbing the spread of tuberculosis, which resurged as a major public health threat in the 1990s. Her innovative approach, which included sending healthcare workers to patients' homes to make sure they completed the drug regimen, is now a model for health departments worldwide. From 1997 to 2001, Dr. Hamburg served as Assistant Secretary for Policy and Evaluation in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Before becoming FDA Commissioner, she served for 8 years at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a foundation dedicated to reducing the threat from a variety of modern weapons. She was the foundation's Vice President for Biological Programs, dealing with reforms to confront the dangers of bioterrorism, as well as dealing with the threats of naturally occurring infectious diseases such as pandemic flu. In August 2011, Forbes magazine named her as one of the 100 most powerful women in the world. She was elected in 1994 to membership in the U.S. Institute of Medicine, one of the youngest persons to be so honored. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to the U.S. FDA Commissioner, Dr. Margaret Hamburg.
Well, thank you for that very generous and complete introduction. My only comment is that my son was very unimpressed when he saw that I'd been named the 21st most powerful woman in America. He said, "I won't pay any attention until you beat Lady Gaga." So I think that's going to be a while. But I'm really delighted to be here this afternoon with all of you. And for me, having been raised on the Stanford campus not too far from here, this is something of a homecoming to be back in the Bay Area. And it's my second time at the Commonwealth Club, so I'm delighted that you were willing to have me back. And it's a wonderful opportunity to address the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum. For over 100 years, the Commonwealth Club has played host to a diverse and distinctive spectrum of speakers, including, as I understand it, every sitting president, starting with Teddy Roosevelt. And I might add that Teddy Roosevelt is, in fact, the president who championed the founding of the FDA. In what's now considered a landmark address given here at the Commonwealth Club, Roosevelt made the case for federal involvement in the protection of common lands for the common good. The question of how best to protect the common good is one that confronts us every day at the FDA. We're responsible for protecting the public health by assuring the safety and effectiveness of human and veterinary drugs, vaccines, the blood supply, and other biological products for human use, and also medical devices. We're responsible for overseeing the safety of our nation's food supply, cosmetics, dietary supplements, products that emit radiation, and most recently, the regulation of tobacco products. Overall, we regulate products that account for about 20 to 25 cents of every dollar that consumers spend on products in America today. And they're products that really matter to people in big ways and in small ways, from the toothpaste that you use to the food that you put on your table, to the drugs that you might need for a chronic or an acute disease. The challenge of protecting the common good especially resonates at the FDA as we mark 50 years since the infamous thalidomide tragedy. No doubt many of you remember in the early 1960s devastating reports that began coming in from around the world of countless women who were giving birth to children with extremely deformed limbs and other birth defects. The mothers had taken a sedative, thalidomide. It was supposed to be a wonder drug for morning sickness. But the medical officer, Dr. Francis Kelsey of the FDA, discovered that thalidomide had not even been tested on pregnant animals. Thanks to her vigilance, the drug was never approved in the United States. Dr. Kelsey's reaction to thalidomide best exemplifies, in some ways, FDA's mission, protecting and promoting the health of the American people using science for regulatory decision-making. But an equally important part of the FDA's mission is to help speed medical products to people. FDA was pivotal in protecting women from thalidomide, and we were very proud to be able to honor Dr. Frances Kelsey just last year for her historic actions. But we must also play a critical role in ensuring that safe and effective products quickly reach patients, whether it's a woman suffering from complications of pregnancy or who's been diagnosed with metastatic cancer, a child with poorly controlled type 1 diabetes, or a teenager who's struggling to breathe because of chronic cystic fibrosis. But there are sometimes tensions between moving new products swiftly out into the marketplace and making sure that they've been adequately studied. As FDA commissioner, I've been surprised by how many people ask whether I favor safety or innovation. I favor both. Protecting the public health while encouraging, not discouraging, innovation must be the goal, and it is. But it's also why a robust, well-resourced FDA with the necessary scientific expertise and capability is so important. And this dual objective leads to a question that I want to address this afternoon. Given the state of our current economy and the never-ceasing challenges to public health, it's a question that's vitally important to all of us and to our nation. Specifically, can smart regulation support public health and private enterprise? I believe, it won't surprise you, that the answer is an unqualified yes, because we actually achieve these dual objectives through the same means, sound, smart, science-based regulation. Now, I know that in some circles, regulation is viewed as a roadblock to innovation and economic growth. Some even insist that regulations per se kill jobs, and more than once I've been called a job-killing regulator. But in actuality, regulation, when it's done right, is not a roadblock. It's the actual pathway to achieve meaningful and lasting innovation. Smart, science-based regulation instills consumer confidence in products and treatments. It levels the playing field for business. It decreases the threat of litigation. It prevents recalls that threaten both products and industry reputation and consumer trust, not to mention levying huge preventable costs on individual companies and entire industries. And I believe it spurs industry to excellence. The fact is, when done right, smart regulation allows us to deliver the promise of science in service of patients, consumers, and yes, to industry. When quality, cutting-edge science, industry leadership, and good regulatory practice combine, when they are working well and working together, the resulting synergy produces tremendously positive outcomes. But take away any of these necessary factors on the continuum of discovery to delivery, and the engines of innovation can stall. Today, in this context, I'd like to share with you some of my perspective on the regulatory role of FDA, and it requires just a little bit of history because it is a story, a journey that begins with the establishment of the FDA and continues today. When the pro-business Teddy Roosevelt lent his support to the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, the founding document of the FDA, he envisioned the legislation as a helping hand for both consumers and free enterprise. He believed that by giving consumers a degree of confidence and security in the safety of the food and drugs that they purchased, it would further market growth, especially for the best businesses. That's why, as I understand it, there was unprecedented, although certainly not wholesale, industry support for the 1906 Act. Many businesses hoped that the regulation would restore the competitiveness of their products on weak foreign and domestic markets, as it would prevent unscrupulous companies from marketing poor quality and often dangerous products. Over the years, Congress gave FDA additional powers to protect and promote public health, often in response to a public health crisis. More often than not, each change was greeted with dire warnings by some voices in industry. For example, when 107 people died after a chemist used a poisonous solvent in a new sulfa drug, Congress enacted the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. The landmark legislation required the basic safety testing of drugs. Naysayers said that the new law would put countless people out of work, close plants, hurt thousands, and, to quote one industry proclamation from the time, help none. But they were wrong. But even with this landmark legislation, by the midpoint of the 20th century, there were still few requirements for studies to determine the actual benefits of a drug. There were no patient protections, there was little post-market scrutiny, and there was very little need for manufacturers to adhere to good manufacturing practices that would lead to more consistently safe and quality products. Then came the uproar over thalidomide. And exactly 50 years ago, in 1962, it prompted Congress to enact the Kefauver-Harris amendments to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Thanks to the new amendments, manufacturers had to prove that a drug was not only safe, but also effective. Approvals had to be based on sound science, typically two well-controlled studies. Companies had to monitor safety reports that emerged post-market and adhere to good manufacturing practices. And there were new additional protections for patients as well. Predictably, opponents said that these new provisions were unnecessary or worse. But these voices had been heard before, and the Kefauver-Harris amendments, I think, really enabled us to create the science-based agency that exists today. Frankly, they allowed the FDA to become the regulatory leader, the gold standard for the world. And above all, they ensured that we could continue to fulfill our public health mission, protecting patients from dangers like thalidomide while enabling safe and effective drugs to be made available to those in need. And while the amendments clearly benefited patients, they also helped industry and helped serve as a catalyst for innovation. For they not only raised scientific standards, but they also helped establish a framework for a new form of scientific research enterprise. In short, you could argue that these amendments helped usher in today's sophisticated science-based biotech and pharmaceutical industry. For the very first time, many companies put in place rigorous research and development programs, including the design and implementation of controlled clinical trials. Major therapeutic breakthroughs resulted, including the use of beta blockers in patients after a heart attack, a variety of well-tolerated antihypertensive agents, and the use of angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors to improve survival in patients with heart failure, just a few examples. All of these were good news for patients and for public health, and for corporate bottom lines, I might add. And by requiring that new drugs and treatments were not just safe, but effective, the best drugs and treatments, rather than those simply most heavily marketed, could rise to the top. At their core, the Kefauver amendments, by demanding excellence and creating a culture of quality and innovation, laid the foundation for our current regulatory environment, which is emulated around the world. It's an environment that has offered enormous progress for patients and consumers while encouraging rather than discouraging private sector innovation and economic growth. And I know that there are skeptics, but I think that we really just need to look at some of the evidence. These are hard times, but even with the current economy, American pharmaceutical, biotech, and medical device companies are maintaining a competitive advantage in the global marketplace. Indeed, our current regulatory environment has fostered the growth of a domestic pharmaceutical industry that is second to none. Under FDA oversight, U.S. pharmaceutical sales from New Jersey alone, I'm told, surpassed those of Australia and the Middle East combined and are nearly as large as sales from all of Asia. And although they may not always like it, I think that companies also find that adhering to FDA's quality standards is beneficial to their bottom lines. After all, a major recall exacts financial and reputational costs. According to McKinsey and Company, quality improvements can boost revenues for medical device companies by 3 to 4%. While companies hit with a product recall or other major quality event can experience a 10% drop in their share price. Moreover, many studies confirm that the FDA's regulatory framework and its standards for safety and efficacy are vital to the trust and confidence of consumers and products and in the companies that make them. FDA approval clearly matters to domestic commerce, and it's an important gateway to international markets as well. In this regard, in answering an earlier charge, I think it can be said that appropriate regulation has helped to create, not cost, jobs. According to a Battelle Memorial Institute report in 2008, the biosciences industry directly employed some 1.4 million people in the United States and ensured about 8 million related jobs. And I know that the past several years have brought new economic constraints, including layoffs in the pharmaceutical sector due to industry consolidation and restructuring. But they're encouraging reports that biomedical product job growth is, in fact, coming back. I just looked at a recent report commissioned by Biocom, a trade organization for life science companies based in Southern California, and they had a report prepared by an independent economic consultant that was examining jobs and economic impact of 3,500 life science companies in that San Diego region. And commenting on the findings of the report, which I haven't read, I have to confess, I saw this in the paper, but I liked the quote, the president, Joe Panetta of Biocom, said, "The data backs up what we've been saying, and that is that the life sciences industry is leading economic growth locally and nationally." This report indicates that this year the industry will employ some 95,000 workers in that region, but that's quite a lot. And these are not dead-end jobs, but high-quality, high-value jobs with an average wage of actually over $100,000. So it's encouraging to see that kind of job and economic growth even in these difficult times. But it takes the right regulation to help support job and economic growth. So I fully understand the private sector's frustration with regulation that isn't as sound or as streamlined as it should be. and we at FDA must address a set of very real concerns. For example, I've heard from small medical device companies and biotech startups who complain that dealing with the FDA can be a daunting experience. Every day that they don't hear back from us can mean lost dollars and lost opportunities for patients. That's why we're establishing a small business liaison who will work with our product centers to help companies navigate the FDA, and why we're putting in place enhanced systems across all of our programs to ensure both the prompt and responsive engagement that companies need and deserve, and clearer guidance about what we expect from them and why. And while there'll never be a guarantee that every product that comes before us will be approved, we can help make the system more transparent, consistent, and predictable. This is what we're committed to do, and I think that this is smart, responsive regulation. Smart regulation also necessitates that the way we regulate never becomes stagnant or archaic, that our regulation responds to changing situations, new information, and new challenges, and always brings the best possible science to bear. All of this requires regulatory flexibility in light of continually changing needs and circumstances, but it also demands that we advance regulatory science, the knowledge and tools necessary for the meaningful and timely review of products for safety, efficacy, quality, and performance. Unfortunately, this has been an area of our overall scientific enterprise and investments that has been woefully underaddressed, but it's absolutely vital if we as a nation want to leverage the opportunities in science and technology today in the form of new, better, and more innovative medical products. And in many ways, in fact, regulatory science is some of the most exciting science today. So advancing regulatory science is a huge priority, not just within the walls of FDA, but as an active, dynamic field of scientific research. We're continually working to find new and better ways of doing things, to seize new opportunities that exist in science and technology, and to work with industry and our scientific partners in academia and government in a collaborative way to discover and apply new regulatory tools. Such things as enhancing the use of pharmacogenomics and qualified biomarkers, developing innovative clinical trial designs which enable studies to be smaller, more efficient, and more adaptive, and developing new strategies using bioinformatics to more effectively mine large databases to learn more about issues of safety and efficacy, as well as questions like, can we identify subpopulations of responders to therapies based on certain indicators, or learn more important information about natural history of disease and patterns of disease. These efforts matter in our ability to swiftly and surely review product applications that come before us. And they also are essential for reducing the time and cost and increasing the likelihood of success for drug development itself. To see the results, I think you only have to look at three of our most recent drug approvals. Voraxaze, which removes the unused portion of a toxic chemotherapy agent from the bloodstream, was approved based on a single 22-patient study. Kaleidoco, first conceived by a San Diego startup, targets a genetic mutation in a small subset of patients with cystic fibrosis. It's the very first product that treats the underlying mechanism of the disease rather than the symptoms, and it offers extraordinary promise. The third new drug, Erivedge, the first FDA-approved drug for metastatic basal cell carcinoma, addresses a new finding for cancer cell growth, the so-called hedgehog pathway. This drug was actually developed right here in San Francisco by Genentech, and I'm proud to say that it was reviewed under the agency's priority review program and was approved a month ahead of its goal date based on a single study that used a non-traditional measure for success. When strong science and quality applications come together, FDA can provide responsible and flexible regulatory oversight, and we have a clear responsibility to make sure this happens. The successful translation of new discoveries in science and the realization of new opportunities into real-world products that people need and can depend on is our foremost goal. but it requires a robust FDA, an agency with the strong scientific and regulatory capacity that can provide the kind of clear, timely, consistent, and reliable science-based regulation that benefits industry and, most importantly, benefits patients. We can only fulfill this crucial role if we have the resources and support we need. Industry understands this, which is why the prescription drug industry is working with the FDA for the reauthorization of the Prescription Drug User Fee Act this year, and why the private sector and academia are engaging with us in new scientific partnerships. I want to just say a little bit about each. The Prescription Drug User Act, or PDUFA, was enacted in 1992 to address a serious problem, the chronic underfunding of the FDA, despite the critical role we play. Its concept was simple. Since industry benefits from FDA pre-market review, which helps to ensure safety and effectiveness, instill consumer confidence, and mitigate litigation, industry should help pay for a portion of the cost. When PDUFA was first implemented, the U.S. lagged badly behind Europe with respect to the introduction of new drugs. We had significant review backlogs, and the drug review program had high rates of staff turnover and inadequate management oversight. Since prescription drug user fees were enacted by Congress, they've greatly expedited drug approvals. They've enabled our agency to hire and train additional drug reviewers, strengthen our review team management, importantly, strengthen our science base, and to provide industry with guidance on getting drugs through the approval process. Now, after several cycles of PDUFA, review times have shrunk, there are no backlogs, and we lead the world in approval of new drugs. In fact, we are regarded as the gold standard for drug regulatory review around the world, and I hear that all the time from my counterpart regulatory authorities. Overall, PDUFA has been so successful, in fact, that it's become the funding model for other medical products. And just last month, FDA sent a proposal to Congress for historic new user fees to support review of generic drugs and also for biosimilar biologics, two very dynamic and important areas for health and health care. And just last week, FDA reached an agreement in principle with industry to reauthorize user fees for medical devices. Even in these challenging political and economic times, I am guardedly optimistic that Congress will move forward in a timely and bipartisan manner with the legislation needed to authorize all of these medical product user fees and the programs and performance goals that we've negotiated with the industry with strong input from patient consumer groups as part of these user fee packages. At the same time, though, it is essential that Congress not take actions that will undermine, intentionally or unintentionally, the standards for safety and efficacy that in fact undergird the overall success of these efforts, and importantly, the benefits for the safety, health, and well-being of the American people. And as we strive to strengthen our regulatory programs and help build the science we need for medical product development and review, we really have come to believe strongly in the power of partnership. We need the best and the brightest to come together to help ensure success and progress. And that's why we have been focusing on advancing regulatory science, as I said, and establishing a series of collaborations, including centers for excellence in regulatory science that cut across disciplines and across sectors. Actually, I spent some time this morning discussing potential collaborations with Sue Desmond-Heldman and UCSF, and we need some more time to work those out. And last month, we signed a memorandum of understanding with Stanford Biodesign, a fellowship training program under the auspices of Stanford University, just down the road from here. This MOU outlines collaboration on educational outreach, cross-training of scientific personnel, and the development of new biostatistical models for more accurately evaluating the safety of emerging medical technologies. Such partnerships help ensure that the work of the FDA reflects the best possible science and supports the standards of the FDA that are so important for us all. But while I can't overestimate their importance, both user fees and partnerships don't provide necessary support for many of our core programs or for many activities that are fundamental for progress. And I know that it's undignified to whine about money. And frankly, over the past few years, the FDA has really been very fortunate to receive budget increases despite these difficult economic times. Nonetheless, I do think that it's really startling to take a look at what we do and at what we receive to do it. If you look at the federal government contribution to the FDA budget and calculate it out, every American pays $8 a year for the services that the FDA provides. And I would suspect that each of you, before you even started your lunch, had used more than $8 of FDA-regulated products. So it's really a challenging situation. So I hope you'll think it's fair for me to close with just a reminder of why all this matters. We need resources to ensure that we always have the best regulatory practices and will continue to find new and better ways of doing things. We need resources to continue to help the private sector and others boost innovation while protecting and promoting the health of the American people, the common good that Roosevelt spoke of during his Commonwealth speech. And we need resources to build an even stronger FDA. Patient groups like the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, which was pivotal in the development of the drug Kalydeco, recognize the importance of adequate and sustainable FDA funding as they look forward to new products on the horizon. That's why they and many other groups have been publicly supporting strong funding for the agency. The naysayers of earlier generations thought a stronger FDA would hurt thousands and help none. Without a strong FDA, I would argue, one endowed with the necessary resources to ensure smart, sound, science-based, cutting-edge regulation, the human as well as the economic costs would be incalculable. As I've discussed this afternoon, such regulation protects the health and welfare of the American people and serves as a roadway to innovation if we do it responsibly and we do it right. It's the kind of regulation that industry needs. It's the kind of regulation that the American people want and expect, and it's the kind of regulation that Teddy Roosevelt probably first envisioned when he signed the Pure Food, Drug, and Food Act into law and forever enhanced the common good. So thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to take a few questions.
Our thanks to FDA Commissioner Dr. Margaret Hamburg. I'm Sue Desmond-Hellman, Chancellor at the University of California, San Francisco, and your moderator for today's audience question period. We'll be taking some verbal questions later on, so please get ready to raise your hand if you have one, and we'll get a microphone to you. Dr. Hamburg, there's a pile here of questions, and I'll welcome you back to Northern California with the first question. A couple of folks asked about FDA's direction for industry and social media. There's been a little buzz about social media in our atmosphere in the last week. And there's one specific question about how does FDA think about crowdsourcing for clinical trials, trying to expedite clinical trial enrollment. But what specifically is FDA's direction regarding industry and social media?
Well, it's an important question and one that I think is especially challenging for those of us to think about that are not as technologically advanced as others. Social media is sort of a scary term to me, but it clearly has relevance to the work that we do. And I think it can have relevance in the area of product development, testing, and review. I think it also can have relevance in the area of better understanding safety issues that might emerge in the post-market setting. I think that on the pre-market side, we need to begin a push that moves how we think about and do clinical research closer out to where the patients are. It's one of the things that we were talking about earlier this morning. You know, I think it slows and isolates and increases the costs of our clinical development activities to have it all done in research universities and, highly targeted clinical trials, networks, and we could really, I think, capture so much more information and engage more patients and really better understand real-world context if we could begin to use new technologies, databases, and information systems to really engage in clinical research that's closer to the patient. Exactly, whether you'd want to use, Facebook for that quite yet, I'm not sure. But this notion of pushing out clinical research closer to patients and using IT and communications strategies and technologies that didn't exist before, I think is very, very important, and we need to explore it more deeply. And then on the post-market side, I think it actually is more obvious how even Twitter and Facebook and other kinds of quick ways of reporting information actually could come together into a system that would enable us to gather important information more swiftly. Then I think we have an obligation in terms of strengthening the science of safety to make sure that we really know how to quickly assess and evaluate in definitive ways the nature of those emerging safety signals, because one thing that scares me is that everyone starts sending information about everything that doesn't feel quite right. We could drown in the data, and we also might inadvertently undermine a quality drug with real benefits by an overemphasis on an emerging but undocumented safety concern.
Great. Thank you. Just a reminder for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is FDA Commissioner Dr. Margaret Hamburg, who is discussing the balance between safety and innovation at the FDA. You mentioned the importance of sound science, and there are a number of questions that get to sound science, some questions about working with industry as compared to academia, novel clinical trials, how to look at the role of understanding metabolism and importance of having active controls, not just placebo controls. But let me ask you, in light of what you said about cystic fibrosis and new targeted therapy for basal cell carcinoma, you're a public health person, and everybody in this audience has a colleague, a friend, or a neighbor with type 2 diabetes. What I hear from many people who are concerned about health is great applause for that kind of targeted precision therapy that you've just told us was approved at FDA. But how does FDA think, and how do you think about what's missing to advance major public health problems like, for example, obesity and type 2 diabetes? What does FDA need to move that more quickly?
Well, it's really an important question and a huge concern of mine, because I do hear frequently from colleagues in industry that there's an increasing hesitation to move into or remain in certain areas of drug development where, from a public health perspective, it really matters, but where some of the challenges for drug development make it unattractive, and chronic diseases such as type 2 diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease are among those areas. And I think we really need to work with the scientific community and with patients to think through some new and better strategies. When you're talking about a chronic disease and when you're talking about exposing individuals and populations to drugs over a very long period of time, you have to take seriously the kinds of potential side effects that may be associated with those drugs. On the other hand, you're talking about chronic diseases that carry a huge burden on health, well-being, productivity, and often early death. So we need to figure out ways to both more effectively balance risks and benefits in that context. And I think they're getting patient voices in is an important component of some new thinking about systematizing and elaborating how we think about risks and benefits. But importantly, we also need to figure out sort of staged ways of studying drugs so that we don't have to have the full time frame of disease course in order to make decisions about introducing a new product. So it involves thinking about new interval markers, surrogate markers, whatever, understanding the underlying mechanisms of disease so whether it's type 2 diabetes or cystic fibrosis, we can develop the best, most targeted therapies. And, you know, we need to think about new ways of monitoring, collecting data, modifying and iterating our assessment of a drug while it's actually in use in the community. And, of course, for diabetes, I'd be remiss not to say that we also shouldn't forget the non-pharmaceutical approaches that can make a difference, including diet and exercise.
Right. So we haven't talked yet about the F in FDA, food, and right. There are a number of questions, but let me give you the context where I think some of how these questions are being asked. A couple of the questions that have come in from the audience talk about the FDA's influence and how much the food industry or industry has an influence on FDA. And the specific concern raised by a number of questioners is FDA and thinking about antibiotic resistance and the role of subtherapeutic treatment of livestock, so specifically the risk of treating livestock with antibiotics and subsequent resistance. How does FDA think about regulating that area of food?
Yeah. Well, just to step back for a second, probably most of you recognize, but it doesn't hurt to underscore, the serious threat of antibiotic resistance that we are facing, and it does require us to act on many levels. One of those is to ensure the appropriate use of the antibiotics that we currently have, both in human medical practice and also in animal and veterinary care, and importantly in animal husbandry. And there's been, you know, quite an ongoing debate about the appropriate use of antibiotics in animal populations that are being raised for food purposes, and growing concerns about the use of antibiotics for growth promotion, not to treat disease, but to help grow more animals more quickly under more crowded conditions. And I think that is an area that we have been focusing on. It's certainly been a debate for decades, but we have taken a couple of targeted actions to begin to address this important area. And we are developing some additional guidelines to continue to really try to ensure responsible use of antibiotics that really matter to animal populations and to human populations, and to ensure that we do not throw away these vital tools of medical practice. At the same time, we also need to do more work, and this is a whole other topic of discussion, on making sure that there are more new candidate antibiotics in the pipeline for future use.
Great. I'm going to ask another question, but I'm going to let the audience know that I'll open it up for verbal questions after this question, so start raising your hand for the microphone. Everyone was at home watching the Super Bowl yesterday, and maybe that's why there are several questions about prescription medications being advertised on TV. although I don't really remember any yesterday. But the specific questions, and these are all very thoughtful, so I'll try and do them justice by summarizing. Do you approve of pharmaceutical companies advertising their prescription products over public media? And specifically, do you think that encourages overuse and abuse? And do you think there are new regulations that are needed regarding specifically TV, but general media advertising by pharmaceutical companies?
Mm-hmm. Well, it really isn't a question of whether I approve or disapprove. It is the law. Companies are allowed to do direct-to-consumer advertising. Interestingly enough, we're one of, I think, only two countries in the world that have direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs. But I think that there are probably cycles of interest around this area of activity. But I have noticed of late that I'm getting more and more questions on this issue, and it may be that the drugs are getting more and more intrusive or unappealing, or I'm not sure what. But I think, and I've talked with colleagues within FDA and with leadership in industry about the opportunity to actually try to reshape some of this advertising in ways that actually can also have an educational component, can actually help people to better understand some of the disease conditions for which these prescription drugs are being advertised, perhaps help give people some deeper insight into whether or not this would be appropriate for them, and perhaps try to target some of the advertising in ways that really address some of the critical public health areas where we need more engagement with the public to address critical health concerns. So I hope we'll see some changes in how direct-to-consumer advertising is done. I was on an airplane rather than watching the Super Bowl, so I didn't see any of it, but I was told there was a lot of fanfare about the new advertisements that were going to be shown during the Super Bowl, prime advertising time, and the fact that you can't remember if there were any direct-to-consumer advertisements or not suggests that either there weren't or they weren't very good. But it is a...
They didn't have babies or pets, the ones that I remembered. Great. So we are... If anyone has a verbal question, there's a number of questions. Yes?
Commissioner Hamburg, it's a pleasure to have you here. You have in the past said that personalized medicine is a priority for FDA. At the same time, the industry perceives major regulatory overhang over genomic assays and lab-developed tests. Can you talk about what the FDA is doing in this area and how you plan to advance personalized medicine?
Well, it is a huge priority for us, and I think it's obviously a huge area of interest, focus, and opportunity in the biomedical sciences more broadly and in healthcare. We are beginning to see some of those first products actually entering the marketplace, linking genetic markers and diagnostics with therapeutic interventions, also seeing, you know, more and more labeling changes that relate to genetic information. And we're certainly seeing, you know, more interest by both companies and sponsors in this area, and I think a growing interest in the public about wanting to see the era of personalized medicine actually ushered in. Within the FDA, there are a couple things going on to support our efforts in personalized medicine, and I do expect it to be an area that's expanding, and I expect that we will be putting out more guidance, and I expect that we will be seeing and reviewing more products that fit under the rubric of personalized medicine. But one of the things that I've done to try to help support our efforts and build our scientific capacity and our regulatory focus is a reorganization of the agency that I did this past summer that included, really, number one, an effort to try to reorganize around our core functions and areas of critical roles and scientific expertise, and bring the medical product centers together under a deputy commissioner for medical products, because personalized medicine depends on much greater coordination and integration of activities, particularly across our drug center and our device center and the linkage of diagnostics and therapeutics. We recruited as deputy commissioner someone who actually has a strong background and interest in personalized medicine, someone who coincidentally is called Steven Spielberg. For those who know him are impressed that we were able to recruit him to FDA. But many people were really stunned when they thought I'd recruited the other Steven Spielberg. But, you know, I told him that one of the things that he is to put at the top of his priority list is really putting forward a sort of a vision for personalized medicine from the FDA perspective, and not just, you know, how are we dealing with the things that are coming over the transom today, but how can we lean into what we expect is going to be happening going forward. So I think it's a very exciting area. We also, as part of that, I think need to hone in on the area of diagnostics. You mentioned laboratory-developed tests, and it's a big issue and, you know, has had its complexities and probably not worth going into too much detail in this setting and with limited time. But, you know, so much is happening in the area of genomics and related diagnostics, and the challenges about how to, you know, really think about and apply the right regulatory framework in this dynamic area with complex science, the right strategies for validating the analytics and the clinical validity of these tests, you know, are very much on our mind. And actually, it's one of the areas where I think that we can do the best job possible if on some of this we actually work in collaboration with academia and industry in terms of really trying to look at what are the best strategies and how can we really share information about, you know, this sort of explosion of potential tests that are emerging. But we do feel we have a real responsibility to make sure that tests that are being used as the basis for important, often highly invasive medical procedures or treatments are based on sound science and demonstration that the test does what it's intended to do and what it claims to do.
Thank you. There's another question.
My question focuses on the F in the FDA, food, and that is how much research is done with the various foods that we ingest, such as soy, for instance, that affect the hormone levels in our bodies and also could maybe be precancerous. How much is the FDA involved with focusing on the foods that influence the hormone levels in our bodies and getting this information out to the public and physicians, the medical?
Well, you speak really to a broader issue about, you know, sort of emerging concerns and advancing science about environmental exposures, often through food or food-related substances, sometimes, you know, through some other substances as well. But advancing our understanding of toxicology writ large and environmental health issues is an area where we are trying to build greater expertise, and also an area where we're trying to really build some of the kinds of partnerships that I was talking about earlier. You know, we need to move in that arena to new ways of doing science. We have very outdated modalities for some of our scientific assessments within FDA, but also I'm talking more broadly about the scientific community, that we need really to modernize and apply new thinking and advances in science to these kinds of assessments. They're complex and hard to do, but they're very, very important. And so we both have a focus on trying to really deepen and extend the scientific underpinning. And then as we fulfill our unique role as the agency responsible for overseeing safety of food, apply that science, identify outstanding issues, and try to bring new science to bear, and then act on the science when we feel that there is adequate science to indicate an important safety concern that requires a modification, or communicate through various avenues when we feel that an issue that has been raised as a concern is in fact not supported by the available science and that people don't need to worry to the degree that they can. But it's an area where there's constantly new information emerging, and we need to you know, really be on top of it and take these concerns very seriously, and we do.
Thank you. There's a question
here. Thank you very much for your remarks. Another question about food. Given the issues of banned pesticides on orange juice, it's just there are broad problems with imported produce that is not, and imported seafood, which have been increasing dramatically in recent years, and the fact that the FDA is really not able to keep up with the massive imports, the fact that these foods may be treated with chemicals that are not allowed in the U.S. And so I'd just, in the context of FDA resources, be interested in what you have to say about how to increase that and protect consumers.
Well, it's a huge area of focus and concern. In fact, amongst my key priorities, strengthening regulatory science is one, responding to the challenges of globalization is another. And the last time I came to the Commonwealth Club, I actually spoke to the issue of globalization and how the world has transformed, and it's critical that FDA really develop new ways of thinking and behaving to address it. It is startling, as you point out, the magnitude of the food supply that is imported, and you know, the trends show that it will continue to increase. I think we're estimating now that you know, maybe as much as 2/3 of fresh fruit and produce eaten in the United States is actually grown and produced elsewhere, and about 80 or 85% of seafood. So it is you know, really striking. You know, we are responsible for overseeing food that's coming from over 100 and some countries, many of whom have much less sophisticated regulatory oversight frameworks than we do. Food that's coming from, you know, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands and thousands of facilities coming into, you know, huge number of different ports of entry as well. So the old model that was really the basis of our authorities as the FDA was that, you know, when the boat came into the port, you know, we'd roll off a few barrels of molasses and inspect them, and then, you know, the shipment would come in. We can't do that anymore when we're talking about millions, tens of millions of imports a year. So we're trying to address it in some critical ways. Resources, obviously, is really important, and we're advocating for that. New authorities is also essential. And actually, the Food Safety Modernization Act, which passed about a year ago, did give us some new authorities to be able to work in a more proactive way internationally. But we need, first, to not abandon the system of screening at the border, but we're using now sophisticated informatics to, in a risk-based way, determine which products need to be inspected, which are high-risk products based on the nature of the commodity, the history of the producer or distributor, certain events that may have happened that may put certain products more at risk. You mentioned OJ, orange juice, black spot, fungal outbreaks in Brazil have led to more use of a fungicide that actually is banned here. And so, you know, targeting, because of that environmental circumstance, that product's high risk. So doing more sophisticated screening at the border to better target limited resources, but importantly, working with our regulatory counterparts around the world and sharing both information about outbreaks and food concerns, sharing information about inspections. We can't possibly be everywhere that we need to be. So if we can share information with other countries that are importing foods and facing the same potential risks as us, we can share the workload and provide a better safety net for protection. And importantly, and I feel very strongly about this, it's not solely up to FDA, but as we think about how we spend development dollars around the world, we should be thinking about building regulatory capacity to improve the safety and oversight of the products being produced in countries with less mature regulatory authorities. It matters for us from the most selfish of perspectives. It also has huge benefits for those countries that can improve the quality and the quantity of food in those countries for their populations. It also can enhance industry and economic development in those countries, providing stable markets domestically and internationally. And it adds to our overall international security, because food supplies do remain vulnerable to deliberate or unintentional contamination that can put us all at risk. So there's a lot going on in that area. I find it a very important and exciting area to be working on. I see real progress, but it's a huge, huge challenge. And we've only talked about the food side. The drug and medical product side is equally complicated in terms of the challenges of globalization.
There's another question.
Hi. In terms of the rapidly rising cost of healthcare, what can and should the FDA be doing to compare the effectiveness of medical therapies, and what role should cost effectiveness play in that?
Well, our mandate as a science-based regulatory agency with a public health mission is to look at the scientific basis for a drug approval based on safety and efficacy and the overall benefit to patients. But cost is specifically not supposed to be a factor in our decision-making. Other regulatory authorities in other countries have different mandates in that regard, but we really are meant to be looking at it in terms of, does the data support the indication for use? We do have a role to play with respect to comparative effectiveness research in a couple of ways, though. One is that, of course, we do look at drugs in relation to other drugs available in the market, and we do use those comparisons in a couple of ways. One is, you know, sometimes we make recommendations for a drug to be used as a second-line drug. Sometimes we, you know, our decision about, for example, what level of risk would be tolerated is very much affected by how many other like drugs there are in the market, as well as, you know, what is the indication for use. But we also do sit on lots of data about drugs, clinical studies, and information about relative benefits that could potentially be used by others to look at important issues in terms of comparative effectiveness. And we do have some projects working with others to better utilize some of the available databases to ask important questions about the use of certain drugs in a broader context.
So, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question.
Thank you very much for your talk. And I noticed that you mentioned communication in a number of areas, getting closer to the patient or to the public. And I've had the privilege of serving on an FDA committee, the Risk Communication Advisory Committee. And I wanted to mention that one of the main findings of that committee has been that although there's a body of scientific work showing that there are good ways to communicate with the public, much of the FDA's communication is at a college level, whereas the average American reads at about an eighth grade level. So my question is, what plans do you have to sort of transform what the FDA does, especially as a major communicator to the public about many health issues? And is there any plan to have some regulations come down about this with pharma and other organizations who are confused as to about what direction to take?
Well, I think the issues of how best to communicate important information are absolutely critical. And we do take the work of your advisory committee very seriously. And I, to be honest, have been a little bit surprised at sometimes how naive we are that we think, number one, if we put something on our website that, you know, all the people we want to see it will have seen it. And also, as you point out, how you communicate certain information, the level from a literacy perspective, and also, you know, just how it's framed really matters in terms of the benefits of the information. We are trying hard both to address the issue of target audience and plain English. I think we have an initiative that's actually called plain language, not plain English, since we also put out communications in other languages, but trying to help different parts of FDA sort of look at the information they're putting out and rethink it in terms of those needs. We're also trying to be a little bit more sophisticated about what kind of groups you use to try to get information out to the right audiences, and how to use networks, either patient advocacy networks or professional societies or educational networks.
And of course, Dr. Hamburg coming to the Commonwealth Club. So I'm going to cut you off because I want to just make sure we have time to give our thanks to Dr. Margaret Hamburg, the 21st Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We also thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the Internet. You're a terrific public health servant and communicator, and great thanks from all of us for being here. I'm Susan Desmond-Hellman, Chancellor at UCSF, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.